This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents A Storm of Swords, Book 3 of A Song of Ice and Fire, by George R. R. Martin, read by Roy Dotrice. Prologue. The day was grey and bitter cold, and the dogs would not take the scent. The big black bitch had taken one sniff at the bear tracks, backed off, and skulked back to the pack with her tail between her legs. The dogs huddled together miserably on the river bank as the wind snapped at them. Chet felt it too, biting through his layers of black wool and boiled leather. It was too bloody cold for man or beast, but here they were. His mouth twisted, and he could almost feel the boils that covered his cheeks and neck growing red and angry.
"I should be safe back at the wall, tending the bloody ravens and making fires for old Maester Aemon."
It was the bastard John Snow who had taken that from him, him and his fat friend Sam Tarley. It was their fault he was here, freezing his bloody balls off with a pack of hounds deep in the haunted forest.
"Seven elves."
He gave the leashes a hard yank to get the dog's attention.
"Track, you bastards. That's a bear print. You want some meat or no? Find."
But the hounds only huddled closer, whining. Chet snapped his short lash above their heads, and the black bitch snarled at him.
"Dog meat would taste as good as bear," he warned her, his breath frosting with every word.
Locke, the sister man, stood with his arms crossed over his chest and his hands tucked up into his armpits. He wore black wool gloves, but he was always complaining how his fingers were frozen.
"It's too bloody cold, Daunt," he said. "Bugger this bear. He's not worth freezing over."
"We can't go back empty hand, Lark," rumbled Smallpaw through the brown whiskers that covered most of his face. "The Lord Commander wouldn't like that."
There was ice under the big man's squash pug nose where his snot had frozen. A huge hand in a thick fur glove clenched tight around the shaft of a spear.
"Bugger that old bear, too," said the sister man,
a thin man with sharp features and nervous eyes.
"Mormont will be dead before daybreak, remember? Who cares what he likes?"
Smallpaw blinked his black little eyes. Maybe he had forgotten, Chet thought. He was stupid enough to forget almost anything.
"Why do we have to kill the old bear? Why don't we just go off and let him be?"
"You think he'd let us be?" said Lark. "He'll hunt us down. You want to be hunted, you great muttonhead?"
"No," said Smallpaw. "I don't want that. I don't."
"So you'll kill him?" said Lark.
"Yes."
The huge man stamped the butt of his spear on the frozen river bank.
"I will. He shouldn't hunt us."
The sister man took his hands from his armpits and turned to Chet.
"We need to kill all the officers, I say."
Chet was sick of hearing it.
"We've been over this. The old bear dies, and Blaine from the Shadow Tower. Grubbs and Aethon as well. They're ill luck for drawing the watch. Dywin and Bannon for their tracking, and Sir Piggy for the ravens. That's all. We kill 'em quiet while they sleep. One scream and we're worm food, every one of us."
His boils were red with rage.
"Just do your bit, and see that your cousins do theirs. And, Paul, try and remember it's third watch, not second."
"Third watch,"
the big man said through hair and frozen snot.
"Me and Softfoot. I remember, Chet."
The moon would be black tonight, and they had jiggered the watches so as to have eight of their own standing sentry, with two more guarding the horses. It wasn't going to get much riper than that. Besides, the wildlings could be upon them any day now. Chet meant to be well away from here before that happened. He meant to live. 300 sworn brothers of the Night's Watch had ridden north, 200 from Castle Black, and another 100 from the Shadow Tower. It was the biggest ranging in living memory, near to a third of the Watch's strength. They meant to find Ben Stark, Sir Waymar Royce, and the other rangers who'd gone missing, and discover why the wildlings were leaving their villages. Well, they were no closer to Stark and Royce than when they'd left the wall, but they'd learn where all the wildings had gone. Up into the icy heights of the godforsaken Frostfangs. They could squat up there till the end of time, and it wouldn't prick Chet's boils none. But no, they were coming down, down the Milkwater. Chet raised his eyes, and there it was. The river's stony banks were bearded by ice, its pale milky waters flowing endlessly down out of the Frostfangs. And now Mance Rayder and his wildlings were flowing down the same way. Thorin Smallwood had returned in a ladder 3 days past. While he was telling the old bear what his scouts had seen, his man, Kedge Whiteye, told the rest of them.
"They're still well up the foothills, but they're coming," Kedge said, warming his hands over the fire. "Harmer, the dog's head, has a van, the poxy bitch. Goldie crept up on her camp and saw her playing by the fire. That fool, Dumblejohn, wanted to pick her off with an arrow, but Smallwood had better sense." Chet spat. "How many were there, could you tell?" "Oh, many and more. 20,000, 30,000. We didn't stay to count. Armour had 500 in the van. Everyone a horse."
The men around the fire exchanged uneasy looks. It was a rare thing to find even a dozen mounted wildlings. And 500?
"Smallwood sent Bannon and me wide round the van to catch a peek at the main body," Kedge went on. "There was no end of them. They're moving slow as a frozen river, 4-5 miles a day, but they don't look like they mean to go back to their villages, neither. More than half were women and children, and they were driving their animals before them, goats, sheep, even oryx, dragging sledges. They'd loaded up with bales of fur and sides of meat, cages of chickens, butcher churns and spinning wheels, every damn thing they own. The mules and garrons were so heavy laden, you'd think their backs would break. The women as well."
"And they follow the Milkwater?" Lark, the sister man, asked.
"I said so, didn't I?"
The Milkwater would take them past the Fist of the First Men, the ancient ring fort where the Night's Watch had made its camp. Any man with a thimble of sense could see that it was time to pull up stakes and fall back on the wall. The old bear had strengthened the fist with spikes and pits and caltrops, but against such a host all that was pointless. If they stayed here, they would be engulfed and overwhelmed. And Thorin Smallwood wanted to attack. Sweet Donald Hill was squire to Sir Malador Locke, and the night before last Smallwood had come to Locke's tent. Sir Malador had been of the same mind as old Sir Otten Withers, urging a retreat on the wall. But Smallwood wanted to convince him otherwise.
"This king beyond the wall will never look for us so far north," Sweet Donald reported him saying, "and this great host of his is a shambling horde, full of useless mouths who won't know what end of a sword to hold. One blow will take all the fight out of them and send them howling back to their hovels for another 50 years.
300 against 30,000. Chet called that rank madness. And what was madder still was that Sir Malador had been persuaded, and the two of them together were on the point of persuading the old bear.
"If we wait too long, this chance may be lost, never to come again,"
Smallwood was saying to anyone who would listen. Against that, Sir Otten Withers said,
"We are the shield that guards the realms of men. You do not throw away your shield for no good purpose."
But to that Thorin Smallwood said,
"In a sword for fair fight, a man's surest defence is a swift stroke that slays his foe, not cringing behind a shield."
Neither Smallwood nor Withers had the command, though. Lord Mormont did, and Mormont was waiting for his other scouts, for Jarman Buckwell and the men who'd climbed the giant stair, and for Corrin Halfhand and Jon Snow, who'd gone to probe the Skirling Pass. Buckwell and the Halfhand were late in returning, though.
"Dead, most like."
Chet pictured Jon Snow lying blue and frozen on some bleak mountaintop with a wildling spear up his bastard arse. The thought made him smile.
I hope they killed his bloody wolf as well.
There's no bear here, he decided abruptly. Just an old print, that's all. Back to the fist.
The dogs almost yanked him off his feet, as eager to get back as he was. Maybe they thought they were going to get fed. Chet had to laugh. He hadn't fed them for 3 days now, to turn them mean and hungry. Tonight, before slipping off into the dark, he'd turn them loose among the horse lines, after Sweet Donald Hill and Clubfoot Carl cut the tethers.
They'll have snarling hounds and panicked horses all over the fist, running through fires, jumping the ring wall, and trampling down tents.
With all the confusion, it might be hours before anyone noticed that 14 brothers were missing. Lark had wanted to bring in twice that number, but what could you expect from some stupid fish-breath sister man? Whisper a word in the wrong ear, and before you knew it, you'd be short ahead. No, 14 was a good number, enough to do what needed doing, but not so many that they couldn't keep the secret. Chet had recruited most of them himself. Small Paul was one of his, the strongest man on the wall, even if he was slower than a dead snail. He'd once broken a wildling's back with a hug. They had Dirk as well, named for his favourite weapon, and the little grey man the brothers called Softfoot, who'd raped 100 women in his youth, and liked to boast how none had never seen nor heard him until he shoved it up inside them. The plan was Chet's. He was a clever one. He'd been steward to old Maester Aemon for 4 good years before that bastard Jon Snow had done him out, so his job could be handed to that fat pig of a friend. When he killed Sam Tarly tonight, he planned to whisper,
"Give my love to Lord Snow,"
right in his ear before he sliced the piggy's throat open to let the blood come bubbling out through all those layers of suet. Chet knew the ravens, so he wouldn't have no trouble there, no more than he would with Tarly. One touch of the knife, and that craven would piss his pants and start blubbering for his life.
Let him beg. It won't do him no good.
After he'd opened his throat, he'd open the cages and shoo the birds away, so no messages reached the wall. Softfoot and Small Paul would kill the old bear, Dirk would do Blaine, and Lark and his cousins would silence Bannon and old Dywin to keep them from sniffing after their trail. They'd been caching food for a fortnight, and Sweet Donald and Clubfoot Carl would have the horses ready. With Mormont dead, command would pass to Sir Utton Withers, an old Don man, and failing.
He'd be running for the wall before sundown, and he won't waste no men sending them after us neither.
The dogs pulled at him as they made their way through the trees. Chet could see the fist punching its way up through the green. The day was so dark that the old bear had the torches lit, a great circle of them burning all along the ring wall that crowned the top of the steep stony hill. The three of them waded across a brook. The water was icy cold, and patches of ice were spreading across its surface.
"I'm going to make for the coast," Lark the sister man confided. "Me and my cousins will build us a boat, sail back home to the sisters."
"And at home they'll know you for deserters, and lop off your fool heads," thought Chet.
There was no leaving the night's watch, once you said your words. Anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, they'd take you and kill you. Ollo Lophan now. He was talking about sailing back to Tyrosh, where he claimed men didn't lose their heads for a bit of honest thievery, nor get sent off to freeze their life away for being found in bed with some knight's wife. Chet had Wade going with him, but he didn't speak their wet, girly tongue, and what could he do in Tyrosh? He had no trade to speak of, growing up in Hagsmire. His father had spent his life grubbing in other men's fields and collecting leeches. He'd strip down bare but for a thick leather clout and go wading in the murky waters. When he climbed out, he'd be covered from nipple to ankle. Sometimes he made Chet help pull the leeches off. One had attached itself to his palm once, and he'd smashed it against a wall in revulsion. His father beat him bloody for that. The maesters bought the leeches at 12 for a penny. Lark could go home if he liked, and that damned Tyrushi too, but not yet. If he never saw Hagsmire again, it would be too bloody soon. He had liked the look of Craster's keep himself. Craster lived high as a lord there, so why shouldn't he do the same? That would be a laugh. Chet, the leechman's son, a lord with a keep. His banner could be a dozen leeches on a field of pink. But why stop at lord? Maybe he should be a king.
Mance Rayder started out as a crow. I could be a king, same as him, and have me some wives.
Craster had 19, not even counting the young ones, the daughters he hadn't gotten around to bedding yet. Half them wives were as old and ugly as Craster, but that didn't matter. The old ones Chet could put to work, cooking and cleaning for him, pulling carrots and slopping pigs, while the young ones warmed his bed and bore his children. Craster wouldn't object. Not once small Paul gave him a hug. The only women Chet had ever known were the whores he'd bought in Molestown. When he'd been younger, the village girls took one look at his face with its boils and its wen, and turned away sickened. The worst was that slattern Bessa. She'd spread her legs for every boy in Hagsmire, so he figured, why not him too? He even spent a morning picking wildflowers when he heard she liked them, but she'd just laughed in his face and told him she'd crawl in a bed with his father's leeches before she'd crawl in one with him. She stopped laughing when he put his knife in her. That was sweet, the look on her face. So he pulled the knife out and put it in her again. When they caught him, down near Seven Streams, old Lord Walde Frey hadn't even bothered to come himself to do the judging. He'd sent one of his bastards, that Walde Rivers, and the next thing Chet had known, he was walking to the war with that foul-smelling black devil, Yoren, to pay for his one sweet moment they took his whole life. But now he meant to take it back, and Craster's women too.
That twisted old wildling has the right of it. If you want a woman to wife, you take her, and none of this giving her flowers, so that maybe she don't notice your bloody boils.
Chet didn't mean to make that mistake again. It would work, he promised himself for the 100th time.
So long as we get away clean.
Sir Utten would strike south for the Shadow Tower, the shortest way to the wall.
He won't bother with us, not with us. All he'll want is to get back whole.
Thorin Smallwood now. He'd want to press on with the attack. But Sir Utten's caution ran too deep, and he was senior.
It won't matter anyhow. Once we're gone, Smallwood can attack anyone he likes. What do we care? If none of them ever returns to the wall, no one will ever come looking for us. They'll think we died with the rest.
That was a new thought, and for a moment it tempted him. But they would need to kill Sir Utten and Sir Malador Locke as well, to give Smallwood the command, and both of them were well attended day and night. No, the risk was too great. "Chet," said Small Paul, as they trudged along a stony game trail through sentinels and soldier pines, "what about the bird?"
"What bloody bird?"
The last thing he needed now was some muttonhead going on about a bird.
"The old bear's raven," Small Paul said. "If we kill him, who's going to feed his bird?"
"Who bloody what cares? Kill a bird too, if you like."
"I don't want to kill no bird," the big man said. "But that's a talking bird. What if it tells what we did?"
Lark, the sister man, laughed.
"Small Paul, thick as a castle wall," he mocked. "You shut up with that," said Small Paul dangerously.
"Paul," said Chet, before the big man got too angry, "when they find the old man lying in a pool of blood with his throat slit, they won't need no bird to tell them someone killed him."
Small Paul chewed on that a moment.
"That's true," he allowed. "Can I keep the bird, then? I like that bird."
"He's yours,"
said Chet, just to shut him up.
"We can always eat him if we get hungry," offered Lark.
Smallpaw clouded up again.
"Best not try and eat my bird, Lark. Best not."
Chet could hear voices drifting through the trees.
"Close your bloody mouths, both of you. We're almost to the fist."
They emerged near the west face of the hill and walked around south, where the slope was gentler. Near the edge of the forest, a dozen men were taking archery practice. They had carved outlines on the trunks of trees and were loosing shafts at them.
"Look," said Lark, "a pig with a bow."
Sure enough, the nearest bowman was Sir Piggy himself, the fat boy who had stolen his place with Maester Aemon. Just the sight of Samwell Tarly filled him with anger. Stewarding for Maester Aemon had been as good a life as he'd ever known. The old blind man was undemanding, and Clydus had taken care of most of his wants anyway. Chet's duties were easy. Cleaning the rookery, a few fires to build, a few meals to fetch. And Aemon never once hit him.
"Thinks he can just walk in and shove me out on account of being high-born and knowing how to read. Might be I'll ask him to read my knife before I open his throat with it."
"You go on," he told the others. "I want to watch this." The dogs were pulling, anxious to go with them, to the food they thought would be waiting at the top. Chet kicked the bitch with the toe of his boot, and that settled them down some. He watched from the trees as the fat boy wrestled with a longbow as tall as he was, his red moon face screwed up with concentration. Three arrows stood in the ground before him. Tarly knocked and drew, held the draw a long moment as he tried to aim and let fly. The shaft vanished into the greenery. Chet laughed loudly, a snort of sweet disgust.
"Cor, we'll never find that one, and I'll be blamed," announced Ed Tollett, the dour, grey-headed squire everyone called Dolorous Ed. "Cor, nothing ever goes missing that they don't look at me. Ever since that time I lost my horse, eh? As if that could be helped. He was white, and it was snowing, eh? What did they expect?"
"The wind took that one," said Gren, another friend of Lord Snow's.
"Try to hold the bow steady, Sam."
"That's heavy," the fat boy complained, but he pulled the second arrow all the same.
This one went high, sailing through the branches 10 feet above the target.
I believe you knocked a leaf off that tree," said Dolorous Ed. "Fall is falling fast enough, eh? There's no need to help it."
He sighed.
"And we all know what follows fall, eh? God, but I'm cold. Cor, shoot the last arrow, Samwell. I believe my tongue is freezing to the roof of my mouth, eh?"
Sir Piggy lowered the bow, and Chet thought he was going to start bawling.
"That's too hard." "Notch, draw, and loose," said Gren. "Go on."
Dutifully, the fat boy plucked his final arrow from the earth, notched it to his longbow, drew, and released. He did it quickly, without squinting along the shaft, painstakingly, as he had the first two times. The arrow struck the charcoal outline low in the chest and hung quivering.
"I hit him!" Sir Piggy sounded shocked. "Gran, did you see? Ed, look, I hit him!"
"Put it between his ribs, I'd say," said Gren.
"Did I kill him?" the fat boy wanted to know.
Tullock shrugged.
"Might have punctured a lung if he had a lung. Most trees don't, as a rule, eh?"
He took the bow from Sam's hand.
"I've seen worse shots, though. Aye, and made a few."
Sir Piggy was beaming. To look at him, you'd think he'd actually done something. But when he saw Chet and the dogs, his smile curled up and died squeaking.
"You hit a tree," Chet said. "Let's see how you shoot when it's Manse Raider's lads. They won't stand there with their arms out and their leaves rustling. Oh, no, they'll come right at you, screaming in your face, and I bet you'll piss those britches. One of them will plant his axe right between those little pig eyes. The last thing you'll hear will be the thunk it makes when it bites into your skull.
The fat boy was shaking. Dolorous Ed put a hand on his shoulder.
Brother, he said solemnly, just because it happened that way for you doesn't mean Samuel will suffer the same, eh?
What are you talking about, Tullet?
Call that axe to split your skull, eh? Is it true that half your wits leaked out on the ground and your dogs ate them, eh?
The big lout grin laughed, and even Samuel Tarley managed a weak little smile. Chet kicked the nearest dog, yanked on their leashes, and started up the hill.
"Smile all you want, Sir Piggy. We'll see who laughs tonight."
He only wished he had time to kill Tullet as well.
"Gloomy, horse-faced fool. That's what he is."
The climb was steep, even on this side of the fist, which had the gentler slope. Partway up, the dog started barking and pulling at him, figuring that they'd get fed soon. He gave them a taste of his boot instead, and a crack of the whip for the big ugly one that snapped at him. Once they were tied up, he went to report.
"The prints were there, like Giant said, but the dogs wouldn't track," he told Mormont in front of his big black tent. "Down by the river like that. Could be old prints."
"Yeah, pity." Lord Commander Mormont had a bald head and a great shaggy grey beard, and sounded as tired as he looked.
"We might all have been better for a bit of fresh meat."
The raven on his shoulder bobbed its head and echoed,
"Meat! Meat! Meat!"
"We could cook the bloody dogs," Chet thought,
but he kept his mouth shut until the old bear sent him on his way.
"And that's the last time I'll need to bow my head to that one," he thought to himself with satisfaction.
It seemed to him that it was growing even colder, which he would have sworn wasn't possible. The dogs huddled together miserably in the hard, frozen mud, and Chet was half tempted to crawl in with them. Instead, he wrapped a black wool scarf around the lower part of his face, leaving a slit for his mouth between the whines. It was warmer if he kept moving, he found, so he made a slow circuit of the perimeter with a wad of sour leaf, sharing a chew or two with the black brothers on guard and hearing what they had to say. None of the men on the day watch were part of his scheme. Even so, he figured it was good to have some sense of what they were thinking. Mostly what they were thinking was that it was bloody cold. The wind was rising as the shadows lengthened. It made a high, thin sound as it shivered through the stones of the ringwall.
"I hate that sound," Little Giant said. "It sounds like a babe in the brush, wailing away for milk."
When he finished the circuit and returned to the dogs, he found Lark waiting for him.
"The officers are in the old bear's tent again, talking something fierce."
"That's what they do," said Chet. "They're high-born, all but Blaine. They get drunk on words instead of wine."
Lark sidled closer.
"Cheese for wits. Keeps going on about the bird," he warned, glancing about to make certain no one was close. "Now he's asking if we cached any seed for the damn thing."
"It's a raven," said Chet. "It eats corpses."
Lark grinned.
"Is, might be."
"Or yours."
It seemed to Chet that they needed the big man more than they needed Lark.
"Stop fretting about Small Paul. You do your part, he'll do his."
Twilight was creeping through the woods by the time he rid himself of the sister man and sat down to edge his sword. It was bloody hard work, with his gloves on, but he wasn't about to take them off. Cold as it was, any fool that touched steel with a bare hand was going to lose a patch of skin. The dogs whimpered when the sun went down. He gave them water and curses.
"Half a night more, and you can find your own feast."
By then he could smell supper. Dywin was holding forth at the cook fire as Chet got his heel of hard bread and a bowl of bean and bacon soup from Hake the cook.
"The wood's too silent,"
the old forester was saying.
"No frogs near that river. No owls in the dark. I never heard no deader wood than this."
"Them teeth of yours sound pretty dead," said Hake.
Dywin clacked his wooden teeth.
"No woods neither. There was before, but no more. Where'd they go, you figure?"
"Some place warm," said Chet.
Of the dozen-odd brothers who sat by the fire, four were his. He gave each one a hard, squinty look as he ate, to see if any showed signs of breaking. Dirk seemed calm enough, sitting silent and sharpening his blade the way he did every night, and sweet Donald Hill was all easy japes. He had white teeth and fat red lips and yellow locks that he wore in an artful tumble about his shoulders, and he claimed to be the bastard of some Lannister. Well, maybe he was at that. Chet had no use for pretty boys, nor for bastards neither, but sweet Donald seemed like to hold his own. He was less certain about the forester the brothers called Saw Wood, more for his snoring than for anything to do with trees. Just now he looked so restless he might never snore again. And Maslin was worse. Chet could see sweat trickling down his face, despite the frigid wind. The beads of moisture sparkled in the firelight like so many little wet jewels. Maslin wasn't eating neither, only staring at his soup, as if the smell of it was about to make him sick.
"I'll need to watch that one," Chet thought.
"Assemble!"
The shout came suddenly from a dozen throats, and quickly spread to every part of the hilltop camp.
"Men of the Night's Watch, assemble at the central fire!"
Frowning, Chet finished his soup and followed the rest. The old bear stood before the fire with Smallwood, Locke, Withers, and Blaine ranged behind him in a row. Mormont wore a cloak of thick black fur, and his raven perched upon his shoulder, preening its black feathers.
"This can't be good."
Chet squeezed between Brown Banar and some Shadow Tower men. When everyone was gathered, save for the watchers in the woods and the guards on the ring wall, Mormont cleared his throat and spat. The spittle was frozen before it hit the ground.
"Brothers," he said, "men of the Night's Watch."
"Men,"
his raven screamed.
"Men! Men!"
"The wildlings are on the march, following the course of the Milkwater down out of the mountains. Thorin believes their van will be upon us 10 days hence. Their most seasoned raiders will be with Harmer Dogshead in that van. The rest will likely form a rear guard, or ride in close company with Mance Raider himself. Elsewhere their fighters will be spread thin along the line of march. They have oxen, mules, horses, but few enough. Most will be afoot, and ill-armed and untrained. Such weapons as they carry are more like to be stone and bone than steel. They are burdened with women, children, herds of sheep and goats, and all their worldly goods besides. In short, though they are numerous, they are vulnerable, and they do not know that we are here. Or so we must pray."
"They know," thought Chet. "You bloody old pusbag, they know. Certain as sunrise. Corin Halfhand hasn't come back, has he? Nor Jarmin Buckwell. If any of them got caught, you know damn well the wildlings will have wrung a song or two out of them by now."
Smallwood stepped forward.
"Mance Raider means to break the wall and bring red war to the Seven Kingdoms. Well, that's a game two can play. On the morrow, we'll bring the war to him."
"We ride at dawn with all our strength," the old bear said, as a murmur went through the assembly. "We will ride north and loop around to the west. Harmer's van will be well past the fist by the time we turn. The foothills of the Frostfangs are full of narrow, winding valleys made for ambush. Their line of march will stretch for many miles. We shall fall on them in several places at once, and make them swear we were 3,000, not 300.
"We'll hit hard and be away before the horsemen can form up to face us," Thorin Smallwood said. "If they pursue, we'll lead them a merry chase, then wheel and hit again further down the column. We'll burn their wagons, scatter their herds, and slay as many as we can. Mance Raider himself, if we find him, If they break and return to their hovels, we've won. If not, we'll harrow them all the way to the wall and see to it that they leave a trail of corpses to mark their progress.
There are thousands, someone called from behind Chet.
We'll die.
That was Maslin's voice, green with fear.
Die,
screamed Mormon's raven, flapping its black wings.
Die, die, die.
Many of us, the old bear said, mayhaps even all of us. But as another Lord Commander said, 1,000 years ago, that is why they dress us in black. Remember your words, brothers, for we are the swords in the darkness, the watchers on the walls.
The fire that burns against the cold,
Sir Maldor Locke drew his longsword.
The light that brings the dawn,
others answered, and more swords were pulled from scabbards. Then all of them were drawing, and it was near 300 upraised swords, and as many voices crying, "The horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men!" Chet had no choice but to join his voice to the others. The air was misty with their breath, and firelight glinted off the steel. He was pleased to see Lark and Softfoot and sweet Donald Hill joining in, as if they were as big fools as the rest. That was good. No sense to draw attention when their hour was so close. When the shouting died away, once more he heard the sound of the wind picking at the ring wall. The flames swirled and shivered, as if they too were cold, and in the sudden quiet the old bear's raven cawed loudly and once again said,
"Die!"
Clever bird, thought Chet, as the officers dismissed them, warning everyone to get a good meal and a long rest tonight. Chet crawled under his furs near the dogs, his head full of things that could go wrong. What if that bloody oath gave one of his a change of heart? Or Small Paul forgot and tried to kill Mormont during the second watch in place of the third? Or Maslin lost his courage, or someone turned informer, or... He found himself listening to the night. The wind did sound like a wailing child, and from time to time he could hear men's voices, a horse's whinny, a log spitting in the fire, but nothing else.
So quiet.
He could see Bessa's face floating before him.
"It wasn't a knife I wanted to put in you,"
he wanted to tell her.
"I picked you flowers, wild roses and tansy and golden cups. It took me all morning."
His heart was thumping like a drum, so loud he feared it might wake the camp. Ice caked his beard all round his mouth.
"Where did that come from? With Bessa?"
Whenever he'd thought of her before, it had only been to remember the way she looked, dying. What was wrong with him? He could hardly breathe. Had he gone to sleep? He got to his knees, and something wet and cold touched his nose. Chet looked up. Snow was falling. He could feel tears freezing to his cheeks.
"It isn't fair," he wanted to scream.
Snow would ruin everything he'd worked for, all his careful plans. It was a heavy fall, thick white flakes coming down all about him. How would they find their food caches in the snow, or the game trail they meant to follow east?
"They won't need Darwin nor Bannon to hunt us down, neither. Not if we're tracking through fresh snow."
And snow hid the shape of the ground, especially by night. A horse could stumble over a root, break a leg on a stone.
"We're done," he realized. "Done before we began. We're lost."
There'd be no lord's life for the leechman's son. No keep to call his own, no wives, no crowns, only a wildling sword in his belly, and then an unmarked grave.
"The snow's taken it all from me. A bloody snow."
Snow had ruined him once before. Snow and his pet pig. Chet got to his feet. His legs were stiff, and the falling snowflakes turned the distant torches to vague orange glows. He felt as though he were being attacked by a cloud of pale, cold bugs. They settled on his shoulders, on his head. They flew at his nose and his eyes. Cursing, he brushed them off.
Samuel Tarley, he remembered. I can still deal with Sir Picky.
He wrapped his scarf around his face, pulled up his hood, and went striding through the camp to where the cowards slept. The snow was falling so heavily that he got lost among the tents, but finally he spotted the snug little windbreak the fat boy had made for himself between a rock and the raven cages. Tarley was buried beneath a mound of black wool blankets and shaggy furs. The snow was drifting in to cover him. He looked like some kind of soft, round mountain. Steel whispered on leather, faint as hope, as Chet eased his dagger from his sheath. One of the ravens quarked.
"Snow!"
murmured another, peering through the bars with black eyes. The first added a "snow!" of its own. He edged past them, placing each foot carefully. He would clap his left hand down over the fat boy's mouth to muffle his cries, and then, "Ooh!" He stopped mid-step, swallowing his curse, as the sound of the horn shuddered through the camp, faint and far yet unmistakable.
"Not now! Gods be damned, not now!"
The old bear had hidden far eyes and the ring of trees around the fist to give warning of any approach.
"Jarman Buckles back from the giant stair," Chet figured, "or Corin Halfhand from the Skirling Pass."
A single blast of the horn meant brothers returning. If it was the Halfhand, Jon Snow might be with him, alive. Sam Tarley sat up, puffy-eyed, and stared at the snow in confusion. The ravens were cawing noisily, and Chet could hear his dogs baying.
"Half the bloody camp's awake."
His gloved fingers clenched round the dagger's hilt as he waited for the sound to die away. But no sooner had it gone than it came again, louder and longer. "Ooh!
Gods!"
he heard Sam Tarley whimper. The fat boy lurched to his knees, his feet tangled in his cloak and blankets. He kicked them away and reached for a chainmail hauberk he'd hung on the rock nearby. As he slipped the huge tent of a garment down over his head and wriggled into it, he spied Chet standing there.
"Was it two?" he asked. "I dreamed I heard two blasts."
"No dream," said Chet. "Two blasts to call the watch to arms. Two blasts for foes approaching. There's an axe out there with Piggy writ on it, fat boy. Two blasts means wildlings."
The fear on that big moon face made him want to laugh.
"Bugger them all to Seven Hells. Bloody armor, bloody Manse Raider, bloody Smallwood," he said. "They wouldn't be on us for another."
"Ooh!"
The sound went on and on and on until it seemed it would never die. The ravens were flapping and screaming, flying about their cages and banging off the bars, and all about the camp the brothers of the Night's Watch were rising, donning their armour, buckling on sword belts, reaching for battle-axes and bows. Samuel Tarley stood shaking, his face the same colour as the snow that swirled down all around them.
"Three!" he squeaked to Chet. "That was three! I heard three! Oh, they never blow three! Not for hundreds and thousands of years. Three means..."
"Others."
Chet made a sound that was half a laugh and half a sob. And suddenly, his small clothes were wet, and he could feel the piss running down his leg, see steam rising off the front of his breeches.
Jamie.
An east wind blew through his tangled hair, as soft and fragrant as Circe's fingers. He could hear birds singing and feel the river moving beneath the boat as the sweep of the oars sent them toward the pale pink dawn. After so long in darkness, the world was so sweet that Jaime Lannister felt dizzy.
"I am alive and drunk on sunlight.
A laugh burst from his lips, sudden as a quail flushed from cover. "Quiet," the wench grumbled, scowling. Scowl suited her broad, homely face better than a smile. Not that Jamie had ever seen her smiling. He amused himself by picturing her in one of Cersei's silken gowns in place of a studded leather jerkin. As well dress a cow in silk as this one. But the cow could row. Beneath her rough-spun brown breeches were calves like cords of wood, and the long muscles of her arms stretched and tightened with each stroke of the oars. Even after rowing half the night, she showed no signs of tiring, which was more than could be said for his cousin, Sir Cleus, labouring on the other oar.
"A big, strong peasant wench to look at, yet she speaks like one high-born, and wears long sword and dagger. Ah, but can she use them?"
Jamie meant to find out, as soon as he'd rid himself of these fetters. He wore iron manacles on his wrists and a matching pair about his ankles, joined by a length of heavy chain no more than a foot long. "You'd think my word as a Lannister was not good enough," he japed as they bound him. He'd been very drunk by then, thanks to Catelyn Stark. Of their escape from River Run he recalled only bits and pieces. There had been some trouble with the jailer, but the big wench had overcome him. After that they had climbed an endless stair around and around. His legs were weak as grass, and he'd stumbled twice or thrice, until the wench lent him an arm to lean on. At some point he was bundled into a traveller's cloak and shoved into the bottom of a skiff. He remembered listening to Lady Catelyn command someone to raise the portcullis on the water gate. She was sending Sir Cleos Frey back to King's Landing with new terms for the Queen. She'd declared in a tone that brooked no argument. He must have drifted off then. The wine had made him sleepy, and it felt good to stretch, a luxury his chains had not permitted him in the cell. Jamie had long ago learned to snatch sleep in the saddle during a march. This was no harder.
"Tyrion is going to laugh himself sick when he hears how I slept through my own escape."
He was awake now, though, and the fetters were irksome.
"My lady," he called out, "if you strike off these chains, I'll spell you at those oars."
She scowled again, her face all horse teeth and glowering suspicion.
"You'll wear your chains, Kingslayer. You figure to row all the way to King's Landing, wench? You will call me Brienne, not wench. My name is Sir Jamie, not Kingslayer. Do you deny that you slew a king?"
"No.
Do you deny your sex? If so, unlace those breeches and show me."
He gave her an innocent smile.
"I'd ask you to open your bodice, but from the look of you, that wouldn't prove much."
Sir Cleos fretted.
"Cousin, remember your courtesies."
"The Lannister blood runs thin in this one."
Cleos was his Aunt Jenna's son by that dullard Eamon Frey, who had lived in terror of Lord Tywin Lannister since the day he wed his sister. When Lord Walder Frey had brought the twins into the war on the side of River Run, Sir Eamon had chosen his wife's allegiance over his father's.
"Castle Rock got the worst of that bargain," Jamie reflected.
Sir Cleos looked like a weasel, fought like a goose, and had the courage of an especially brave ewe. Lady Stark had promised him release if he delivered her message to Tyrion, and Sir Cleos had solemnly vowed to do so. They'd all done a deal of vowing back in that cell, Jamie most of all. That was Lady Catelyn's price for loosing him. She had laid the point of the big wench's sword against his heart and said, "Swear that you will never again take up arms against Stark nor Tully. Swear that you will compel your brother to honour his pledge to return my daughter safe and unharmed. Swear, on your honour as a knight, on your honour as a Lannister, on your honour as a sworn brother of the King's Guard, swear it by your sister's life and your father's, and your son's, by the old guards and the new, and I'll send you back to your sister. Refuse, and I will have your blood." He remembered the pick of the steel through his rags as she twisted the point of the sword.
I wonder what the High Septon would have to say about the sanctity of oaths, sworn while dead drunk, chained to a wall with a sword pressed to your chest.
Not that Jamie was truly concerned about that fat fraud, or the gods he claimed to serve. He remembered the pail Lady Catlin had kicked over in his cell. A strange woman, to trust her girls to a man with shit for honour, though she was trusting him as little as she dared.
She is putting her hope in Tyrion, not in me.
Perhaps she is not so stupid after all, he said aloud. His captor took it wrong. I am not stupid, nor deaf. He was gentle with her. Mocking this one would be so easy, there would be no sport in it.
I was speaking to myself, and not to you. It's an easy habit to slip into, in a cell.
She frowned at him, pushing the oars forward, pulling them back, pushing them forward, saying nothing.
As glib of tongue as she is fair of face. By your speech, I judge you nobly born.
My father is Selwyn of Tarth, by the grace of the gods, Lord of Evenfall. Even that was given grudgingly.
Tarth, Jamie said, a ghastly large rock in the narrow sea, as I recall. And Evenfall is sworn to Storm's End. How is it that you serve Rob of Winterfell?
It is Lady Catlin I serve. She commanded me to deliver you safe to your brother Tyrion at King's Landing, not to bandy words with you. Be silent.
I have had a belly full of silence, woman.
Talk with Sir Cleos, then. I have no words for monsters.
Jamie hooted.
Oh, are there monsters hereabouts? Hiding beneath the water, perhaps, in that thick of willows? And me, without my sword?
A man who would violate his own sister, murder his king, and fling an innocent child to his death, deserves no other name.
Innocent? The wretched boy was spying on us.
All Jamie had wanted was an hour alone with Cersei. The journey north had been one long torment, seeing her every day, unable to touch her, knowing that Robert stumbled drunkenly into her bed every night in that great creaking wheelhouse. Tyrion had done his best to keep him in a good humour, but it had not been enough.
"You will be courteous as concerns Cersei, wench,"
he warned her.
"My name is Brienne, not wench.
What do you care what a monster calls you?"
"My name is Brienne,"
she repeated, dogged as a hound.
"Lady Brienne."
She looked so uncomfortable that Jaime sensed a weakness.
Or would Sir Brienne be more to your taste? He laughed. No, I fear not. You can trick out a milk cow in crupper, crinet, and chamfron, and bart her all in silk. But that doesn't mean you can ride her into battle.
Cousin Jamie, please, you ought not to speak so roughly. Under his cloak, Sir Cleos wore a surcoat quartered with the twin towers of House Frey and the golden line of Lannister. "We have far to go. We should not quarrel among ourselves."
"When I quarrel, I do it with a sword, cuz. I was speaking to the lady. Tell me, wench, are all the women on Tarth as, homely as you? I pity the men, if so. Perhaps they do not know what real women look like, living on a dreary mountain in the sea."
"Tarth is beautiful," the wench grunted between strokes. "The Sapphire Isle, it's called. Be quiet, monster, unless you mean to make me gag you."
"She's rude as well, isn't she, cuz?" Jamie asked Sir Cleos. "Though she has steel in her spine, I'll grant you. Not many men dare name me monster to my face."
"Though behind my back they speak freely enough, I have no doubt."
Sir Cleos coughed nervously.
"Lady Brienne had those lies from Catelyn Stark, no doubt. The Starks cannot hope to defeat you with sword, sir, so now they make war with poisoned words."
"They did defeat me with swords, you chinless cretin."
Jamie smiled knowingly. Men will read all sorts of things into a knowing smile if you let them.
"Has Cousin Cleos truly swallowed this kettle of dung,
or is he striving to ingratiate himself? What do we have here? An honest muttonhead, or a lickspittle? Sir Cleus prattled on blithely. Any man who believed that a sworn brother of the king's guard would harm a child does not know the meaning of honour. Lickspittle. If truth be told, Jamie had come to rue heaving Brandon Stark out of that window. Cersei had given him no end of grief afterwards when the boy refused to die. He was seven, Jamie, she berated him. Even if he understood what he saw, we should have been able to frighten him into silence. Well, I didn't think you'd want. You never think. If the boy should wake and tell his father what he saw. If. He had pulled her into his lap. If he wakes, we'll say he was dreaming. We'll call him a liar. And should worse come to worse, I'll kill Ned Stark. And then, what do you imagine Robert will do? Let Robert do as he pleases. I'll go to war with him if I must. The war for Cersei's cunt, the singers will call it. Jamie, let go of me, she raged, struggling to rise. Instead, he had kissed her. For a moment she resisted, but then her mouth opened under his. He remembered the taste of wine and cloves on her tongue. She gave a shudder. His hand went to her bodice and yanked, tearing the silk so her breast spilled free, and for a time the Stark boy had been forgotten. Had Cersei remembered him afterward, and hired this man, Lady Catelyn spoke of, to make sure the boy never woke? If she wanted him dead, she would have sent me. It's not like her to choose a cat's paw who would make such a royal butch of the killing. Downriver, the rising sun shimmered against the wind-whipped surface of the river. The south shore was red clay, smooth as any road. Smaller streams fled into the greater, and the rotting trunks of drowned trees clung to the banks. The north shore was wilder. High, rocky bluffs rose 20 feet above them, crowned by stands of beech, oak, and chestnut. Jamie espied a watchtower on the heights ahead, growing taller with every stroke of the oars. Long before they were upon it, he knew it stood abandoned, its weathered stones overgrown with climbing roses. When the wind shifted, Sir Cleus helped the big wench run up the sail, a stiff triangle of striped red and blue canvas. Tully collars, sure to cause them grief if they encountered any Lannister forces on the river, but it was the only sail they had. Brian took the rudder. Jamie threw out the leeboard, his chains rattling as he moved. After that they made better speed, with wind and current both favouring their flight. "We could save a deal of travelling if you deliver me to my father instead of my brother," he pointed out. "Lady Catelyn's daughters are in King's Landing. I will return with the girls, or not at all." Jamie turned to Sir Cleus.
"Cousin, lend me your knife."
"No," the woman tensed. "I will not have you armed." Her voice was as unyielding as stone.
"She fears me, even in irons."
"Cleus, it seems I must ask you to shave me. Leave the beard, but take the hair off my head." "You'd be shaved bald?" asked Cleus Frey. "The realm knows Jamie Lannister as a beardless knight with long golden hair. A bald man with a filthy yellow beard may pass unnoticed. I'd sooner not be recognized while I'm in irons." The dagger was not as sharp as it might have been. Cleus hacked away manfully, sawing and ripping his way through the mats and tossing the hair over the side. The golden curls floated on the surface of the water, gradually falling astern. As the tangles vanished, a louse went crawling down his neck. Jamie caught it and crushed it against his thumbnail. Sir Cleus picked others from his scalp and flicked them into the water. Jamie doused his head and made Sir Cleus wet the blade before he let him scrape away the last inch of yellow stubble. When that was done, they trimmed back his beard as well. The reflection in the water was a man he did not know. Not only was he bald, but he looked as though he had aged 5 years in that dungeon. His face was thinner, with hollows under his eyes and lines he did not remember.
"I don't look as much like Cersei this way,"
She'll hate that.
By midday, Sir Cleus had fallen asleep. His snore sounded like ducks mating. Jamie stretched out to watch the world flow past. After the dark cell, every rock and tree was a wonder.